All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a deep dive into a case. It's Estin v. Estin, a Supreme Court case from 1948. And this is one of those cases that you might have skimmed over in your family law class, but it's actually pretty huge because it introduced us to this idea of divisible divorce.
Yeah, that's right. It really changed the game for how states deal with divorce, especially when you've got people living in different states, and especially when it comes to alimony. We're going to see how this case really boils down to a bit of a constitutional puzzle, you know, trying to balance the powers of different states and figuring out what happens to someone's financial security when their life, their marriage, crosses state lines.
And to understand how all of that plays out, we really have to start with the Constitution itself and, more specifically, the Full Faith and Credit Clause.
Right.
That's the part that basically says that states have to respect each other's laws and court decisions. But as we'll see, things aren't always so simple and straightforward.
Yeah, the Full Faith and Credit Clause can get pretty tricky. I mean, how far does that respect really have to go? Estin v. Estin really forces us to confront that question.
So let's get into the story behind this case. It all starts with Gertrude and Joseph Estin. They get married in 1937, settle down in New York. But then a few years later, in 1942, Joseph takes off.
Right. And a year after that, Gertrude goes to court in New York and gets a legal separation. As part of that separation, the New York court orders Joseph to pay her $180 a month in alimony.
Which at the time was, I mean, that was a significant amount of money.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially back then. So we've got a clear financial obligation that's been put in place by the New York court, right? That's the foundation of the whole legal battle that's about to unfold.
So Joseph, meanwhile, he's moved all the way out to Nevada by 1944. And just a year later, in 1945, he decides to file for divorce. Now remember, Gertrude is still back in New York.
And this is where it gets interesting, because Joseph serves Gertrude with divorce papers, but it's not done in person in Nevada. It's what's called constructive service. Basically, you probably just put a notice in a local newspaper or something like that, which was considered sufficient back then.
You know, I always wonder about those kinds of legal notices. Like, did anyone actually ever see them? Did they really work?
Well, I mean, in this case, Gertrude clearly got the message somehow because she knew about the divorce proceedings in Nevada. The thing is, she didn't actually go to Nevada or participate in the case.
So she basically just ignores the whole thing.
It seems that way. So Joseph gets his divorce in 1945 from the Nevada court. But here's the catch. The Nevada divorce decree doesn't even mention the alimony payments that had been ordered by the New York court.
So it's like the Nevada court just pretended that the New York order didn't exist. Like, oh yeah, you two aren't married anymore. And by the way, whatever financial arrangements you had in New York, those don't matter to us.
Well, that's certainly how Joseph saw it. He figures, I'm officially divorced now. That means those alimony payments, they're done. And that's exactly what he does. He stops making the payments.
Which, of course, doesn't sit well with Gertrude.
No, not at all. So what does Gertrude do? She goes back to the New York courts. And she sues Joseph for all the alimony payments that he skipped out on.
And the New York courts, they took her side. Both the trial court and the Court of Appeals, they basically told Joseph, listen, Nevada might have ended your marriage, but you still have to pay up. You owe Gertrude that money based on what our court ordered.
So now you've got this situation where Nevada is saying they're divorced and New York is saying, yeah, but you still owe her money. That's a real clash, a real interstate legal conflict brewing.
And this conflict is exactly why the case ends up going all the way to the Supreme Court. They have to sort out this mess, right? This is a direct confrontation with the Full Faith and Credit Clause. And the Supreme Court has to answer this really big question. Does New York, does a state, have to accept a divorce decree from another state, even when that decree might undermine or ignore a previous financial obligation?
Yeah, like in this case, should New York have to say, okay, Nevada, you called it, no more alimony, even though they had their own order in place? It was a really tricky situation for the Supreme Court to untangle.
So what do they decide?
Well, the Supreme Court came back with, I think, kind of a surprising answer, at least for Joseph. They basically said, nope, New York doesn't have to just roll over and accept the Nevada divorce decree as ending the alimony obligation. In a nutshell, the Supreme Court said that the Nevada divorce did its job. It ended the marriage. It officially dissolved the marital status, but it didn't have the power to automatically wipe out Joseph's responsibility to pay Gertrude alimony. New York, according to the Supreme Court, could still hold him to that previous alimony order.
Okay, so I feel like there's more to unpack here. Like, how did they arrive at that decision? What was their reasoning?
Right. So if we dig into the majority opinion, it was written by Justice Douglas. He basically laid out the argument that while states generally have to respect each other's judicial proceedings, there are limits to that obligation. New York wasn't obligated to automatically prioritize Nevada's divorce decree over its own policy of providing financial protection to its residents, especially when it came to alimony.
So it sounds like there's a jurisdictional element here, right? Like, did Nevada even have the authority to decide what happens with the alimony in the first place?
Exactly. That's a key piece of this puzzle. To really understand the court's decision, we have to get into the nitty-gritty of jurisdiction, which is basically just the power of a court to make a legally binding decision.
So, like, in order to make a decision that everyone has to follow, the court has to have the right type of jurisdiction.
Precisely. Now, in this case, the Nevada court, they definitely had what's called in rem jurisdiction over the marriage itself. Why? Because Joseph, the person seeking the divorce, he lived in Nevada. And in rem jurisdiction, just think of it as jurisdiction over a thing. In this situation, that thing is the marriage, the legal status of being married or not married. Since Joseph was a resident of Nevada, Nevada had the legal power to say, you two are no longer married. And that decision, that change in their marital status, has to be recognized by every other state.
So Nevada had the power to change their status from married to not married. But what about the alimony? Does that fall under the same type of jurisdiction?
That's where things get a bit more complex. Alimony isn't about a legal status, it's about financial obligations between two specific people. To make a ruling on something like that, a court needs what's called in personam jurisdiction. That means they need jurisdiction over the person who's going to be ordered to pay, in this case, Joseph.
But Joseph was in Nevada, right? So what's the problem?
The problem is Gertrude. Remember, she never went to Nevada, never participated in the divorce case there. She wasn't personally served with papers in Nevada. So because of that, Nevada didn't have personal jurisdiction over her, which means, legally speaking, they couldn't just issue a ruling that affected her rights.
And her right to that alimony, that had already been decided by a New York court, right? So it's like Nevada could change their married status, but they couldn't reach across state lines and change Gertrude's financial situation, a situation that New York had already made a decision about.
That's a great way to think about it. And this is precisely where the Supreme Court's concept of divisible divorce really comes into play. They're essentially saying that a divorce has two parts. First, you've got the legal termination of the marriage, that in rem part we talked about. And then second, you've got the financial obligations, things like alimony that might exist between the people who were married. It's possible for one state to have the power to handle one of those parts, but not necessarily the other, especially if they don't have the right kind of jurisdiction over both people involved.
So you could have a situation where a state can legally end a marriage, but they can't touch the financial stuff unless they have that personal jurisdiction over both spouses.
Right. And that's what happened in Esten. Nevada could end the marriage, but they couldn't just erase Gertrude's right to alimony. Especially because, remember, alimony isn't just some random agreement. It's a court-ordered obligation that was put in place by a court that did have jurisdiction over both Gertrude and Joseph.
Which brings up another interesting point. Why is alimony considered a property right in this context? It's not like Gertrude owned some piece of land in Nevada that they were trying to divide up.
That's a great question. The reason alimony is seen as a property right in this case goes back to that New York court order. When that court granted Gertrude alimony, it created a legally binding obligation for Joseph to pay her a specific amount of money on a regular basis. And that obligation, that right to that stream of income, it becomes almost like a contract. It's a right that's backed by the power of the court. And without having the proper legal authority over Gertrude herself, Nevada just couldn't step in and wipe away that right. It's about protecting individuals, making sure that someone can't lose legally established financial support without due process.
So in this case, the Supreme Court's decision in Esten, it really seems to be about protecting Gertrude, making sure she wasn't left high and dry after a divorce that she wasn't even fully a part of. Were all of the justices on board with this divisible divorce idea?
Well, not exactly. Like with many Supreme Court cases, you had some justices who had different interpretations, different ideas about how the law should be applied. There were a couple of dissenting opinions that raised some really thought-provoking points.
So who are the dissenters and what did they have to say?
One of the dissenting opinions was written by Justice Frankfurter. He argued that the Supreme Court should have first looked at how New York courts handled their own ex parte divorce decrees.
And just as a reminder, an ex parte divorce is one where only one spouse is participating, right?
Right.
Like what happened with Joseph in Nevada.
Exactly. So Frankfurter's argument was basically this. Let's first figure out what New York would do in a situation where one of its own residents gets an ex parte divorce in New York. Would they allow that divorce to just cancel a previous alimony order? If New York wouldn't allow that, if they wouldn't let their own ex parte divorces wipe away alimony, then they shouldn't be forced to recognize Nevada's decree doing the same thing. Frankfurter felt that the majority opinion was kind of jumping the gun, potentially imposing a standard on New York that New York itself wouldn't even follow.
So it's like he's saying, let's make sure New York is playing by its own rules before we start telling them how to treat other states' rules.
Exactly. He thought the Supreme Court should have focused on clarifying New York law first.
Okay, so we have Frankfurter, who's not quite on board with the majority's reasoning. Was there anyone else who disagreed?
Yeah, Justice Jackson also had a dissenting opinion, and he really went after the whole concept of divisible divorce head on. He argued that if the Nevada divorce decree was going to be recognized at all under the full faith and credit clause, then it should have the same full comprehensive effect as a divorce decree issued in New York.
So in his view, it's all or nothing. Either you fully recognize the Nevada divorce with all of its consequences, or you don't recognize it at all.
That was his argument. He thought the majority opinion was creating this kind of illogical middle ground. He pointed out that in New York, if a couple got a divorce after having a separation decree and an alimony order, the divorce would generally terminate the alimony. It would be seen as part and parcel of ending the marriage. So Jackson was basically saying, look, if we're giving any credence to the Nevada divorce, it should have the same effect as a New York divorce. Otherwise, it just creates this weird inconsistency where someone can be legally divorced but still be legally obligated to pay alimony.
So he's raising a fairness issue as well.
Exactly. He thought it was unfair to Joseph to be put in a position where he's no longer married but still has to pay alimony. And he thought the divisible divorce idea just created more legal confusion than it solved.
I think these dissenting opinions, they really highlight something really important about the Supreme Court. You've got these brilliant legal minds grappling with these complex issues. And even at the highest level, there isn't always one clear-cut answer. There's room for interpretation, there's room for debate, and there are often valid arguments on both sides.
I totally agree. I think it's really valuable to understand those different perspectives, even if you ultimately agree with the majority opinion.
So beyond this specific case, beyond Gertrude and Joseph, what's the lasting impact of Esten v. Esten? Why should law students, why should anyone really care about this case from the 1940s?
That's a great question. And the answer is that Esten is still incredibly relevant today, even though it was decided so long ago. The idea of divisible divorce that came out of this case, it's had a huge influence on how we approach interstate legal disputes, particularly in family law.
So what are some examples of how Esten has shaped the legal landscape, so to speak?
One area where you see the influence of Esten is in child custody and child support cases. You often have situations where parents live in different states, and the courts have to figure out which state has the authority to make decisions about the child's upbringing and well-being. The principles from Esten about personal jurisdiction versus jurisdiction over a legal status, they come into play all the time in these cases.
It's not just about divorce anymore. It's about any kind of family law issue that crosses state lines.
Exactly. And, you know, Esten also became especially significant in the years leading up to nationwide marriage equality. Same-sex couples who were legally married in one state but then moved to a state that didn't recognize their marriage, they faced a lot of legal uncertainty, especially when it came to things like divorce. The divisible divorce idea from Esten, it provided at least a partial framework for navigating these really complex situations. It allowed courts to potentially recognize the termination of a legal status that was granted in another state, even if the state where the couple now live didn't recognize the marriage itself.
It sounds like Esten almost provided a legal workaround during a time when there was a lot of conflict and inconsistency between states on the issue of same-sex marriage.
That's a good way to put it. It wasn't a perfect solution, but it did offer a way to address some of the legal challenges that arose from having different states with drastically different laws on marriage.
And, you know, even today, with the rise of online divorces and people moving around more than ever, the questions that Esten raised about jurisdiction, about which state has the right to grant a divorce, and what happens to pre-existing financial agreements when couples split up across state lines, these questions are still front and center.
Absolutely. The tension that Esten highlights, that inherent tension within the full faith and credit clause, it's still something we're grappling with. How much authority does one state have to ignore or modify a legal judgment from another state? And as we saw in Esten, that authority isn't absolute. It's limited by fundamental principles of jurisdiction and fairness.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, what are the big takeaways you'd want our listeners to walk away with? What are the key things to remember from Esten v. Esten?
Well, I think there are three really crucial points. First, personal jurisdiction is absolutely vital when it comes to legal rulings that have an impact on someone's finances or property rights across state lines. A court can't just issue an order that affects someone's money or property unless it has that direct connection, that personal jurisdiction over that individual.
So that's takeaway number one. What's number two?
The second big takeaway is that the full faith and credit clause, it doesn't mean that states have to blindly accept every single legal decision that comes out of another state, especially if there are serious jurisdictional problems. States still have their own sovereignty. They have the right to protect their own residents and to uphold their own laws and policies.
And lastly, the concept that we've been discussing throughout this episode.
Right. The idea of divisible divorce. That's the third key takeaway from Esten. The concept that a divorce can be separated into different parts, the legal ending of the marriage itself, which is that in rem part, and the financial obligations between the former spouses. And different states might have the power to handle different parts, depending on whether they have jurisdiction over the people involved.
It's a reminder that divorce, it's not always a clean break. It can be a very complicated process,
especially
when you factor in different states and different laws.
Absolutely. And I think Esten really highlights how complex our legal system can be, especially in a country where people are constantly on the move. Crossing state lines doesn't mean you can just escape legal obligations.
It's definitely a case that shows just how interconnected our lives are, even across state borders. So to leave you, our listeners, with something to ponder, we have one final thought. Given the complexity of interstate disputes, particularly when it comes to family law and financial obligations, how do we ensure that our legal system is fair and that it provides clear and consistent outcomes, even as our lives become increasingly mobile and interconnected? Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Esten v. Esten.
Thanks for having me.